It's a Thanksgiving takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and thanks so much for spending part of your holiday with us. We begin today with something you might already have on your mind: food. We'll have conversations this hour about what defines American food, how the Food Network has shaped our views on cooking, and how gentrification of ingredients is affecting people across the country. But we start with Thanksgiving itself. And I wanted to know where our traditional foods came from, why we eat what we eat on this day, and how that's changed over time. So I turned to food historian and writer Sandy Oliver, and she brought me back, way back, to the very beginning, where she says turkey probably wasn't the main event.
The only thing we know for sure was that there was venison. The settlers in Plymouth finally had a decent summer. They had an actual harvest. And so the governor said, well, this calls for a celebration, which was essentially an English harvest festival. They went ahead and they started cooking their feast, and the governor said that they began to exercise their arms, which is just another way of saying that they were out target shooting. The Native Americans and the Wampanoags in the Plymouth area heard. They heard all this shooting. They were somewhat alarmed, as they should have been. And so Massasoit gathered up some of his people, marched themselves over to the settlement, the English settlement. And when they realized that the English were just having a big party, Massasoit asked his men to go and get some deer. And they came back with 4 deer. So we know that there was venison, but everything else is sort of a guessing game.
Well, that was then. How about now? Oliver has spent many years thinking about Thanksgiving and the food we serve on that day. And I asked her, how has our Thanksgiving table evolved since the 1600s?
Remarkably little. But there are some important things here. First of all, we didn't add potatoes to any kind of a Thanksgiving feast until the early 1700s, because that's when potatoes were reintroduced to New England at any event. And by the early 1700s, most colonial governors were declaring a Thanksgiving holiday of some sort or another. It could have occurred any time in November, early December. Green beans. Well, that green bean casserole that we all look forward to and which has been around for about 3 generations now was invented in a test kitchen. That's a relatively recent addition, but already, 3 generations old. Turkey. Oh, that was a very fashionable dish in the 1700s, 1800s. It was considered a really wonderful festive bird to put on the table. You know, it's all big and golden and all.
What about different parts of the country? Have they influenced our Thanksgiving table in any way?
You know, the South added the sweet potatoes and pecan pie and some other wonderful things. It took them a while to get on board with it. There were certainly Thanksgiving meals held in the South in the early, early days, but the kind of national Thanksgiving holiday that you and I think of, they didn't adopt that until the later 1800s. And then as soon as they were with us, out come all these wonderful sweet potato dishes and these other kinds of pies. So yeah, you bet they did. And cornbread dressing too. That was something that the South added to our dinner.
You said that there were many different Thanksgivings celebrated in New England in the colonies. Was there a reason or a day that Thanksgiving became an official holiday?
Yeah, that was the result of a direct effort by Sarah Josepha Hale, who was the editor of Godey's Lady's Book. She lobbied for years and years and years, several presidents, culminating finally with Abraham Lincoln. She really felt that a national observance of Thanksgiving would be a wholesome thing for our national health. And as the West was being settled, the New England, all the northern tier states sent people west, and they took their Thanksgiving tradition with them.
Now, why do you think this holiday in particular is so central to our identity as Americans? I mean, one of the things that sticks out to me is that unlike Christmas and other holidays that we celebrate, this one seems I mean, it's very connected to who we are as Americans. Why do you think that is?
Because it really was developed here. I don't think it's easy to go into fall and all the abundance that comes from out of our gardens. If you go past farm stands, you see mounds of pumpkins and squashes, and you might even see turkeys wandering in fields. It's really hard not to observe that the fall is an exceptionally abundant time of year. And it's the one thing that we share all across the country, all on the same day, no matter where or how you worship or how you vote or anything else. This is a day to get together with family or friends and just be grateful.
Sandy Oliver is a food historian and food writer, and she joined us from Maine. Sandy, thanks so much for joining us.
Have a good Thanksgiving.
Thanks, you too. Thanksgiving may be known to many as the quintessential American holiday, as food historian Sandy Oliver just mentioned. But for some, that story of pilgrims and Native Americans coming together peacefully over a feast, well, it's problematic.
Thanksgiving as a national holiday should absolutely just drop that Native narrative and really focus on something that doesn't alienate an entire group, which is food, which is something that we can all enjoy and something that we can all share.
Chef Sean Sherman is founder and CEO of The Sous Chef and the author of The Sous Chef's Indigenous Kitchen. Today, he's seeking a new approach to Thanksgiving, one that's centered on food. But even as a child who was born and raised on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, Sherman says he was taught the same sugar-coated Thanksgiving story everyone else was.
Any school system will hear pretty much the same story of the pilgrims and Indians feasting and, the cutout hand turkeys and the whole works. So we went through that exact same learning, even on Pine Ridge Reservation in the 1970s.
And in terms of what your Thanksgiving table looked like when you were a kid, describe that for us.
Very typical. You know, we utilized just a lot of those recipes from the 50s and 60s. A lot of them were straight out of like Betty Crocker type cookbooks, turkey, mashed potatoes, stuffing. You know, because we were on the Pine Ridge Reservation, we would have sometimes some more Lakota dishes like taniga, which is a soup made out of intestine and stomach. We also had a sauce called wojapi, which is made out of chokecherry, pieces like that.
Now, you were familiar with what Native foods and Indigenous foods were as a child, were you not?
You know, there were some of those pieces, and it wasn't until I, was much older and really shifted my focus as a chef to really try to understand what my Lakota ancestors were eating. And I did have a realization that I did not know much about it. And looking around, it looked like a lot of people didn't know much about Indigenous foods either. So there was definitely some tribes that had a lot of recipes and some tribes that didn't. And I just really wanted to try and figure that all out. So it kind of sent me on a path to understand what my Lakota ancestors were eating.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that process of rediscovering some of the Indigenous foods, or rediscovering or even discovering?
Yeah, so it was a matter of, just realizing that there was very little Indigenous food representation out there in the culinary world. I mean, still today, there are very few Native American restaurants. You have giant cities like New York or LA or Chicago with zero Indigenous Native American restaurants that are, particularly to the history and the land of where those cities stand. And those are huge food cities too, right? So for me, trying to look backwards, I really had to try to understand what was an Indigenous food system. So we started looking at, what were people growing in particular areas and the history of the agriculture of those regions and what kind of seeds and plants were they growing, with all the different kinds of corns and beans and squash and sunflower and amaranth and chilies, just depends on where you are. And just looking at the immense of diversity of those pieces and how people were processing them and utilizing them, but also looking at the knowledge of all the plants around them in general. So looking at the wild foods that were out there and, understanding that all these plants have a purpose. They're medicine, they're utilitarian. You can make, paints and clothing and all sorts of stuff with them and using them in that very resourceful kind of way. So we just started really seeing food around us. We stopped using the word weed because that just meant we didn't know what it was. And we spent time, researching to find out the meanings of these plants and what they could use for, just like our ancestors did. And looking at cooking techniques and food preservation techniques. And, you know, even if you're on the ocean, you have a whole other world of food right offside the shore there of all the plants and animals and shellfish and everything. So it was really looking at every different region, because when you look at, you know, an indigenous perspective of North America, you see, you know, there's hundreds of groups still alive today. There's 574 federally recognized tribes in the U.S., 634 in Canada, and up to a fifth of Mexico still speaks an indigenous language. And there's so much diversity amongst that, that it should be exciting for people to really understand how indigenous peoples were utilizing the foods and plants around them for everything, and, you know, how we can move that forward to just celebrate our regions so much deeper.
Is it part of a movement, I'm wondering, to quote unquote decolonize our food?
You know, there has been a movement happening, and it's not just about decolonizing. We really call it more of a kind of an indigenous evolution, because, you know, for a lot of indigenous groups out there, we've been in kind of a constant state of oppression ever since the inception of reservation systems and, you know, the immense loss of land and lives that happened in the 1800s and before that. You know, for me, I was just reaching back to my great-grandfather's generation who grew up and foresaw that change, because when I was born on Pine Ridge in 1974, it hadn't even been 100 years since the Lakota were all forced onto the Pine Ridge Reservation, you know, so it wasn't that much time that has passed. But today we see tribal communities all over the U.S. and Canada, and people really digging back to understand their food a lot deeper and, you know, growing out a lot of these heirloom native seed varietals and really pushing, because it becomes a really healthy diet on top of all that. So we see a whole bunch of chefs and seed keepers and growers and farmers and ethnobotanists and all sorts of wonderful community organizers over the past few years.
You know, food is the central theme to what we're talking about on Thanksgiving. It's the central theme to the day. When you're thinking about your journey to learning about Native and Indigenous foods and Thanksgiving specifically, how do those things come together? I'm wondering if you see that as a process of reclaiming the holiday or just making it what you want it to be, making it something different.
Yeah. So, you know, I did a lot of research on the history of Thanksgiving. You know, I was really looking for, when did that story particularly become a part of our school curriculum, you know, and I found through researching that it was really during the time of the turn of the century, around the late 1800s, early 1900s in our progressive era. And there was a rise of nationalism happening because people were afraid of this huge influx of immigrants coming into the United States, and people wanted to instill what was, you know, Americanism, basically. They really took to the colonial ideology, and stories like particularly Thanksgiving becomes instilled into our curriculums and our schools everywhere. So that's why 70 years later, on Pine Ridge Reservation, I'm learning that exact same story of something that had nothing to do with Native people, because the Native people were never consulted when coming down to it. It was just this portrayal of Americanism in a colonial period. So I think it's just restructuring it. And again, you know, not alienating an entire group over it and just, you know, celebrating what it should be about, which is thankfulness and gratitude.
Sean Sherman is the founder and CEO of The Sous Chef and author of The Sous Chef's Indigenous Kitchen. Sean, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me again.
And happy Thanksgiving.
All right.
There are some Thanksgiving food items that many Americans expect to see on the table. Turkey, stuffing, cranberry sauce. So what's on your table that makes your Thanksgiving unique? Is there a dish that represents your family's cultural heritage? Well, for me, my Puerto Rican family has always added our own flair to the Thanksgiving staples. For us, we eat arroz con gandules, or rice with pigeon peas, and pasteles, a traditional holiday dish made of plantains, pork, and more. And that's always helped our table feel like ours. I asked some takeaway producers for a tour of their Thanksgiving tables.
My family is Kenyan. At first, we started with the traditional turkey and gravy. And then over time, we realized that no one eats a turkey. Like, we're just wasting all of this turkey. And, you know, Africans, we hate wasting food. And for my parents to just throw away food, you know that it's a big deal, that this got to go. Like, we just got to keep it true to ourselves. And so our dishes are this thing called chapati, which is a fried bread that can be served with a variety of stews. is just more authentic to us. And so we're just more excited to be gathered around the table. The plates are clean.
So every year, my dad makes these sweet potatoes that his dad made for Thanksgiving. Super whipped, fluffy sweet potatoes, usually with roasted pecans, chopped up really fine. A lot of bourbon, like more than maybe is safe for a child to eat. So every single year, my dad calls his dad on Thanksgiving to get the recipe for these sweet potatoes, even though he's been doing it my whole life. But it's kind of a nice tradition between father and son.
My grandmother would make chitlins, which are hog guts. They're not particularly tasty, but I do eat them out of obligation. Sorry, grandmother.
My wife is Filipina, and every time we go to Thanksgiving at her family's, they seem to cook a turkey in the middle that's purely decorative that nobody touches. And then alongside that, we'll eat the kinilaw and the caldereta and the fresh lumpia that everybody really wants to enjoy.
I hate turkey. And so each year, my mom would cook a soup so I could put turkey pieces in there and have turkey noodle soup to alleviate that. Thanks, Mom.
That was Takeaway staff Jake Howitt, Rob Gunther, Jeremy House, Isabel Angel, Polly Arungu sharing there. What about you? What do you have at Thanksgiving that reflects your family's heritage and traditions?
Hi, my name is Dee. I'm calling from Yonkers, New York. We're from Antigua, and we include things like peas and rice, braised oxtails, stuffed red snapper, and some of our local drinks, which is ginger beer, sorrel, and our local fruit punch.
Hi, my name is Desi, and I live in South Carolina. And as a Native American, we don't really celebrate Thanksgiving, but instead we honor the memory of our ancestors, and I cook a lot of traditional Native American food.
Hi, this is Sean from St. Paul, Minnesota. We have lots of Norwegians in our family, so we always have plenty of freshly made lefse at the Thanksgiving table.
Hi, my name is Lori from North Babylon, New York. I became a vegetarian in college 36 years ago. I found a great recipe for a vegetable nut loaf, which has become our family's Thanksgiving main dish. It celebrates harvest food and is absolutely delicious.
Hi, I'm Jacqueline from Tampa, Florida. My family is Greek. We have at least a few Greek-inspired dishes at Thanksgiving, like lamb and spinach pie.
This is Patrick from Salem, Oregon. We used to make turkey with blueberry stuffing for Thanksgiving. As we've gotten older, the leftover chores have kind of pushed us towards foods we like. And this year, we're having shrimp and rice.
Thanks for sharing with us. You can always find us on Facebook and on Twitter. We're at The Takeaway, and I'm at Tanzina Vega.
Go to OmahaSteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut age-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to OmahaSteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. For the rest of this special Thanksgiving episode, we're revisiting some of our favorite food conversations from earlier this year. And we can't talk about food in America without talking about the Food Network. And you've probably watched some of their shows. I know I have.
Bam! That's a little bam.
A little salt and pepper, and that's going to slide right out.
Happiness is a sharp knife.
For the first course, you had to find a way to combine catfish, tomatillos, rutabagas, and marshmallows.
There's one more ingredient to this battle. Our secret ingredient.
It's a crepe challenge, and his crepe was just superior.
So how has the Food Network affected our relationship with food? Kara Miller is going to help us out with that. She's the host of WGBH and PRI's Innovation Hub.
So you kind of have to go back to the early 1990s, and people who worked in cable at that time, and cable was still a pretty young industry in the early 90s, they understood that even though at that time there were just a few dozen channels, it was about to explode. There was going to be hundreds of channels. That was coming down the road. And so it was a gold mine, right? They were trying to think, what could you possibly put on television? Because you were going to be able to put it all on television. And there was a man named Reese Schoenfeld who had helped launch a little channel, you've probably heard of it, called CNN. And he decided maybe he could also help launch a food-themed channel. Now, the great irony of this is that Schoenfeld knew nothing about cooking, and he and his wife had actually had their kitchen removed from their New York City apartment because they figured, well, they live in New York. They don't need a kitchen.
That's a really hardcore move there.
I think they just had a coffee maker and like a place for dog food, and that was it. But he did also realize that there was one very compelling argument for like having a channel that was all about food. Here's journalist Alan Salkin, who has chronicled the rise of the Food Network.
The argument for a Food Network was that it was cheap. That is really as simple as you can get. It was programming you could put on the air 24/7 that wouldn't cost very much. Therefore, if you just sold a few ads, you could go into profit.
And so before the Food Network went on the air, did people in the food world or in the TV world think that this was going to succeed?
You know, Alan Salkin actually says that though there were arguments for the Food Network, the arguments against it were probably more solid at the time. So there were cooking programs already. They were on PBS, most famously Julia Child, right, had hosted a bunch of cooking programs. But there were other people like Martin Yan, who hosted a program called Yan Can Cook.
I remember PBS. Yan Can Cook. Yes.
Exactly. I watched that too. These were successful shows, but they were not huge money makers. So a lot of people thought the idea of having a 24-hour Food Network was craziness. And I talked to a former assistant of Julia Child, Sarah Moulton, who actually then went on to become an on-air personality on the Food Network for just about 10 years. And I asked her, you know, when executives took you out to lunch in New York in the early 1990s and said, do you want to be a part of this network? Like, what did you think? Did you think, this is going to succeed? This is going to make me famous?
Never in a million years, ever. I thought the network wouldn't last. And when I first did it, I said to my producer, when I first had my live call-in show, I was like, well, let's just, you know, do 3-month contract at a time because I'm just not sure how this is going to work. No, I didn't think it was going to last.
In the beginning, and Sarah Moulton will say this, anybody who you talk to who is on the Food Network will say this, this was a shoestring operation. They would start rolling tape, and if somebody cut him or herself, they would often keep rolling, and the person would have to bandage themselves on television. So this was, they didn't have a whole lot of money in the beginning. But Sarah Moulton said that very quickly, she felt like, I'm being recognized everywhere. She started to wonder, should I wear makeup all the time? Like, even when I go out to get, you know, coffee in the morning, because people were always looking at her. And then I think there were a couple of sort of big inflection points for the Food Network. And one was actually right after the attacks of September 11, 2001. And the Food Network, people might remember, they went off the air for a while. They didn't really know what to do. This actually happened to a bunch of cable channels. They just didn't know when they should return to regular programming. And the clamor that came in from viewers, please, please put cooking back on the air, was really quite incredible. And they realized that a lot of people turned to this network for comfort. And then another inflection point, very different, happened a few years later. And it was a new program that the Food Network aired from another country. It was called Iron Chef. It was from Japan. It was dubbed into English. And it just became, it was kind of a crazy show, and it became this huge breakthrough hit. And then Iron Chef Japan had the American chef, Bobby Flay, come on, and that just, like, totally captivated Americans. And I think that started Food Network down a bit of a different path.
Well, and that's where my interest comes into food programming. I love the competitive cooking element of these shows. Is competitive cooking really, was that a critical part of the rise of Americans watching food programming?
Certainly the success of Iron Chef pushed Food Network to have lots more Chopped and Cupcake Wars and all these things. And they all, if you think about it, have this kind of reality TV dimension to them. They have these kind of behind the scenes or like straight to the camera interviews with people. But I think it another aspect of this is that it also kind of affected the culture around food. So people, on the one hand, became aware of more unusual techniques, more unusual ingredients. And in some ways, turning food into a competition, it can make you feel like This is super fun to watch, but it is not necessarily doable at home. And we heard from Alan Salkin earlier, who has written about the rise of the Food Network. He says, you know, obviously the Food Network has not made people stop cooking, but that doesn't mean it hasn't had an effect.
Now, the televisions are so big that it almost looks like you're looking at your own kitchen. It's high def. It's like a window, except the kitchen is probably neater than your own kitchen, more updated, and the person cooking is probably more beautiful than the person cooking in your own kitchen. And the food that's being produced is probably more beautiful than anything you can imagine producing.
I love that description of like sitting in your easy chair and being like, that what I see on television looks good, but I'm not quite so sure that I'm ready to do this at home. And it has coincided, the rise of the Food Network, with this sort of fascinating phenomenon, which is the decline of actual cooking in America.
Kara Miller is the host of the radio program Innovation Hub from our partner station WGBH in Boston.
Hi, I'm Teresa calling from Wilmington, Delaware. We're a fairly large Irish-Italian family, and we have extended family and friends to Thanksgiving dinner. This year, we're planning for 19 of us. However, we're pretty straightforward with what we serve. All the usual suspects, from the relish and cheese plate to pumpkin pie and coffee. Why mess with success?
This is Patrick from Salem, Oregon. We used to make turkey with blueberry stuffing for Thanksgiving, but as we've gotten older, the leftover chores have kind of pushed us towards foods we like, and this year we're having shrimp and rice.
So I've been thinking about some of the dishes I grew up with in my own Puerto Rican family, and not just at Thanksgiving, but all year round. I've already mentioned a couple, arroz con gandules and pasteles, which are just so hard to make, but they're so good when they come out right. Here in New York City, there's at least one spot from my childhood where I know I can always find a pastel. Casa Adela is a Puerto Rican restaurant in the East Village, right near where I grew up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Adela Fargas opened it back in 1976, and though she passed away earlier this year, her family is still running the restaurant. I went to Casa Adela over the summer to see how the family keeps its Puerto Rican culinary traditions alive. It's a hot July day at 66 Avenue C, and the gold letters on the windows here boast authentic Puerto Rican cuisine since 1976. Inside, it already feels familiar.
I feel like I'm in Puerto Rico with the heat.
Casa Adela is a small, sunny spot with just a handful of tables and some huge fans on the floor that try to keep the air moving. You can hear them as I sit down to talk with Maritza Lopez, Adela's daughter-in-law, who still works here every day.
She was my mother-in-law. I loved her to death. And Adela was the type of person that even though she had this restaurant, she didn't know how big she was. She was humble. We are authentic Puerto Rican. And we do basic pernil, arroz con gandules, chuletas, chicharrón de pollo. We specialize in our rotisserie chicken and our mofongo.
I have the cookbook, Cocina Criollo. Have you heard of it? It's the Valdeyuhi book.
Yes, I have heard of it.
It's like the original 1950s Puerto Rican cookbook, right? Here at Casa Adela, do you guys use any cookbook or is it just all the recipes from Adela herself?
No cookbook at all. It's all Adela's. She did it her way, a pinch of this, and everything had to be in exactly her order. But she knew what she was doing.
And as we're chatting, Gadriel Rivera, Maritza's 22-year-old son and Adela's grandson, walks into the restaurant. Maritza waves him over to join us at our corner table, and I asked him how he learned to cook the island's food.
The restaurant was my playground. So it's pretty much, instead of being outside, my grandmother would teach me. You know, she'd be like, if you're not doing anything, come inside, watch. Because she knew that I love to cook. She taught me how to make pasteles. It was so fun because it was like, she taught me how to like wrap them and whatnot so they're like, they don't fall apart. So it was cool.
There's a lot of young people. Maybe your son is not one of them. But I know there's a lot of younger Puerto Ricans who don't know how to make the food that you guys make here because we lost it. We didn't spend enough time. We weren't taught. Like, do you worry that we're going to lose Puerto Rican culture or a big part of the Puerto Rican culture, which is food, if, you know, younger people don't start learning how to make it?
Well, that's up to their parents because I have my kids. I have three. And my daughter cooks it at home. It wasn't perfect. And I'm surprised. She can do rice. She could do beans. She could do pernil. My son loves to cook. So it has to start at home.
How do we keep this going? How do we, I mean, you guys are going to keep it going because you are a family of Adela, but how do the rest of Puerto Ricans keep this tradition of pasteles for Christmas, arroz con gandules, you know, on a Friday, maybe? Like, how do we keep it going?
The culture will never die out, but in the sense of, like, if everybody just, even Puerto Ricans, just to look up, I think there's, like, tutorials on YouTube, since now that everybody's like into that website and, you know, looking up things how to make it.
I use the combination of two different cookbooks and the internet.
What happened to the old way of asking your mom? I mean, I don't know if she's alive.
I can do that too. I made a pernil this winter. My mom was like, I see you're making this pernil and you're putting it on Facebook, but you didn't invite anybody. Say, because I don't know if it's gonna turn out good.
My first white rice, I was so impressed and I was so proud of it. And my mom took it and made a ball out of it and threw it against the wall and said, there's something wrong with this rice. But I learned.
All right. And I will invite mom to the table, I guess, literally.
Okay, so let me, I want to see you doing that capurria then.
Challenge accepted, but you might have to wait about 6 months till I get it right.
She's going on the internet. Go ask your mom. I'm sure you get a shortcut. Family members are number one.
Big thanks to Maritza Lopez, Gabriel Rivera, and everyone at Casadela for hosting us. You can see a few photos of our afternoon there at thetakeaway.org. And we're still hearing from you about food in America. Give us a call. Let us know what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE. For years, we've seen struggles over the gentrification of city neighborhoods. But what about the gentrification of food? Food gentrification is a term we've seen used more and more in recent years. It describes how once affordable and staple ingredients can become trendy, costly, and ultimately out of reach for poorer communities who once depended on them. And it's a pattern that presents challenges for the more than 40 million Americans who live in food insecure households. And it's an issue that our next guest, writer and feminist Mickey Kendall, has thought a lot about. Mickey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So this idea of food gentrification, when you started tweeting about this a couple of years ago, what sort of prompted that word to come from you? What were you thinking about then?
So this is going to sound a little petty, but I had been out to lunch with a friend, and on the menu, they had ham hocks. And it was like a side dish of ham hock, chopped ham hock. It was $8.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody at our table ordered it. And it was like a saucer, like a tea saucer of meat, not even like a full saucer. And I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, $8? Eight? Are you kidding me? So I had talked about that a little bit. And we always talk about gentrification, its impact on neighborhoods and communities. And I talk a lot about food and access. And so somehow or the other, in the middle of ranting, admittedly, I started to talk about how we've gentrified the ingredients themselves. It's not even just the housing or the schools, or but also the things you can buy in that local grocery store, how much they actually cost, assuming you have a local grocery store.
But I wonder how many people do think about SNAP benefits and food stamp benefits, et cetera, and the struggle that people in low-income neighborhoods in particular have to find food, access food, and just generally to pay for food.
I think about it because for several years after my divorce, I was on food stamps. And I, you know, I was in school and I was working and I'm a veteran, so I got the GI Bill and all of that. But I remember being one of the few people in my neighborhood who could get to the end of the month, right? And on paper, food stamps were the primary source of my food budget. In reality, I was shorting myself on other things to make sure we had groceries. I know intimately how close it can be, how much you have to shop on sales, how important coupons can be, and also how difficult it can be to come up with meals when your budget is X and this costs Y.
Let's talk a little bit about food shaming. How does gentrification of food play into or not play into or influence food shaming when someone is made to feel bad because they pick up something from McDonald's when that's what they can afford?
Well, part of it is that we tend to focus on this idea of clean eating, good food, that kind of a thing, right? And we ignore, for a host of reasons, that the reason you would have lard in the refried beans, for instance, was that lard was cheap and shelf-stable and blah, 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 but also that was another source of protein and nutrients. It may not be a source you're comfortable with. It may not be the healthiest source, but it was absolutely a source that was affordable. But someone will say, well, those people should be eating better and they should be drinking this and they shouldn't be spending that. And what is happening instead is that we ignore all of the other factors to say, well, it must be their diet. We don't talk about what's available in the grocery store in the first place.
And let's be clear, too, that the selection in a lot of grocery stores and corner stores, particularly in urban communities and low-income communities, is very limited.
Absolutely. So you've got, you know, the quarter water and the pizza. If you have the money left over, you maybe get a pickle or some candy, that kind of a thing. That's going to get you through till dinner, or maybe your dinner. Well, I could do that with this $2, $2.50, whatever, $3. Or I can buy 4 apples. Hmm. Well, apple a day, okay, great. Except an apple's calorie content is what? A lot less than the 800,000 or so you might get from the pizza and the quarter water.
And you also mentioned money. That's such an important part of this, because when we think about Chinese takeout, right, mm-hmm. or Mexican taco trucks, we tend to value the food. We don't tend to value the people who cook the food, especially at that level.
Because there's a weird, and I'm going to say pioneer, urban pioneer is a phrase I've seen lately, right? This idea that somehow you've discovered Korean food, you've discovered Mexican food, you've discovered soul food. And if you were really about, oh, let's share this food with my friends and empower this community, you wouldn't feel the need to repackage it and sell it yourself. You would start directing people to that wonderful place or trying to invest in that business so that business has a broader reach, right? But what's being seen is, oh, there's profit to be made, and I don't need to bring those people along because they might damage my profit. And then on top of that, we undervalue certain types of cuisine as a result, right? So we will think that these multi-step, multi-layered meals, well, that shouldn't cost more than, because the person serving it doesn't look to our mind like the color or the gender of the person who should be making a lot of money, who should be a celebrity often, right? We've seen a lot of soul food. I'm picking on soul food. We've seen a lot of elevation of soul food and what's authentic soul food arguments between people who have no connection in any way, shape, or form to that cultural tradition, but they think they have a right to some level of ownership over it. If we're going to talk about who creates authentic soul food recipes, grandma and grandpa do.
What are some of the consequences, sort of circling back to living in low-income communities here and seeing your food being gentrified and maybe seeing the Whole Foods, maybe not in your immediate community, but close enough? What are some of the consequences to the gentrification of food for lower-income families, families who are food insecure?
Well, one of the things is that because you can't afford those staple ingredients for the handful of healthy home-cooked meals, right? When we see the price go up for the collard greens, for the oxtails, for whatever, you're left with what you can afford. X costs too much, so I'm going to have to settle for Y as a decision we've all made at some point in our lives. So then you are no longer feeling that cultural connection with other members of your community even, because those foods don't just exist as, oh, this is a thing I put in my mouth to fuel me. That's community, that's family weekends, that's Sundays, that's your memories that you can no longer access in the same way.
Mickey Kendall is a writer and feminist, and she's currently working on a book called Hood Feminism. Mickey, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Back with you on a Thanksgiving takeaway. And we want to welcome the folks who aren't normally hanging out with us. Either you're off from work or you're driving to dinner. Either way, we really want to welcome you to the show. You can always check us out on our podcast. We're there for you with new stories every day. So, back to food. How do you define American food?
Typically, we think about, you know, the hot dogs, the hamburgers, the barbecue. You know, my mission, I guess, has always been to let's expand that definition.
That's chef and writer Edward Lee. Born to South Korean immigrant parents in Brooklyn, Lee now owns restaurants in Kentucky and Maryland, and he spent a lot of time thinking about what American food really is. In fact, he spent 2 years traveling across the United States, meeting people and eating the food that makes up our nation's culinary landscape.
to me, American food is the luxury of diversity. You know, what we have in this country is something so precious. I can wake up, have a Jewish breakfast, have an Indian lunch, and have a Mexican dinner. You don't get that in very many countries around the world.
Lee's new book is called Buttermilk Graffiti, A Chef's Journey to Discover America's New Melting Pot Cuisine. I asked him how he came to take this cross-country journey and what he found along the way.
So, you know, I grew up in a neighborhood near Canarsie, Brooklyn, which was very diverse, right? Jamaicans and Indians, but also Italians and Polish. And I just grew up eating international food, not thinking anything of it. It was just, that's just what you ate. I thought the whole world was like that. And I had a restaurant in New York City when I was in my early 20s, and 9/11 happened. And it forced me to sort of look at things very differently, and I lost my restaurant. And for the first time, I thought, you know what? I could actually go out and discover this thing called America, which I had never really knew about, because growing up in New York or in Brooklyn is not typical America. So I went on these different road trips, and lo and behold, I ended up in Louisville, Kentucky. I drank some bourbon, and I decided to make it home for the next 16 years. So I started to eat country ham and biscuits and gravy and fried chicken and collard greens and all these wonderful foods of the American South that had such a long and twisted history, a very complex cuisine. And I started to go, well, I love collards, but I kind of want to add kimchi to it. And I love barbecue sauce, but I kind of want to add fermented Korean chili paste to it. I didn't do it to sort of force the issue. I just kind of thought, hey, this tastes good to me. And little by little, people also started thinking it was good too. So I just continued down that road. And so I've become this chef that has sort of incorporated, you know, a lot of different experiences from my history in my food. So I really, you know, tell people, like, I don't know what kind of cuisine I cook. I just cook the cuisine of my life, of my history. You know, it's part Korean, it's part global, it's part Southern.
Now, I actually have been to South Korea. I lived there for about a month many, many years ago. When I came back to the United States and ate Korean food here, I noticed, wow, this isn't the same. Do you see similar, like, sort of interpretations of meals or food, whether it be Korean food or other types of food, that you think, what happened there? How did things get lost along the way?
Listen, there's no traditional Korean food in America because we're using American beef, and we're using American chili peppers, and we're using American products, and we're forced to sort of modify the food for a different audience. Authentic Korean food only exists in Korea. Once it winds up on these shores, people have to improvise. They get influenced by their neighbors. They might find that they like American cheese on top of, you know, bulgogi. As any chef or any artist will tell you, like, food is not static. It doesn't, you know, belong in a mausoleum. It transforms. It evolves. It always is making, you know, modifications. And that's what happens. That's a great thing that happens when food comes to this country. It just grows and evolves. And eventually, it ends up looking very different from the food of the homeland. And I always say, like, when I think about American food, I just think about anyone who's ever come to this country and cooked and couldn't find an ingredient and improvised with something else is cooking American food, but looking at it through a foreign lens, right? So you're cooking American food, but with a Korean lens, or you're cooking a food that's American, but with an Italian lens or a French lens or a Nigerian lens. You know, all we do is to struggle to preserve something of the cuisine of our homeland, while at the same time, we're trying to assimilate with what's happening in this country. And that's an experience that is very unique to this country.
I also find it interesting that sometimes the food is accepted before the people, if you will, are accepted. Mexican food, if you will, has sort of become part of the quote-unquote American food culture, right? Tacos everywhere, taco trucks. and yet we have this cognitive dissonance, I think, between our love for all food Mexican and this bizarre tension with people who are of Mexican descent or who are immigrants?
Oh, 100%. What I've always found interesting is that when we write about high-end cuisine, we speak about the chefs in very human terms. They're very glowing, they're very warm, very personal writing. And when we talk about tacos or pho or, you know, falafels, we generally find a list where it's like the 10 best tacos you can find for under $5. And we never talk about the people that are actually cooking those tacos, even though there is a human being cooking those tacos. And so part of my thing with the book was that I wanted to see if there were stories out there. I wanted to find the actual people that cooked these humble foods that we all find that we love, but we never really want to get into the people that cook the food.
I'm wondering also about something that I see in New York a lot, and I'm sure you see it around the country, is also the gentrification of food, is what I'm calling it. And what I mean by that is taking, a taco or a food item that is from a community that is not yours, essentially, and repurposing it, maybe making it more glam, usually means making it smaller and more expensive. What are your thoughts on that?
Food has always been appropriated. Food has always been, shared and stolen and intermixed. This is part of the history of cuisine. There's no cuisine that has existed in isolation. So when we gentrify food, it's an art. We are elevating it into an art form. It happens with any elevated art form. People have been complaining or lauding this about music for time beginning. I do believe there's room for both. What happens is as we gentrify food, as we take it out of its original context and make it pretty, it becomes that much more important to actually go back and look at the history of that food.
Edward Lee is the author of Buttermilk Graffiti, A Chef's Journey to Discover America's New Melting Pot Cuisine. Edward, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for us on this Thanksgiving. But before we go, I really want to take a moment to say how thankful I am for the staff here at The Takeaway. Let's call them out by name. Producers Isabel Angel, Alexandra Boti, Ethan Overman, Rob Gunther, Jose Olivares, Jeremy House, and Joseph Zeballos as our intern. Jay Cowett is our director and editor, and Vince Fairchild, Claire McKean, and Victoria Washington are our engineers. David Gable is our administrative assistant, Polly Irungu is our digital producer, Amber Hall is our planning editor, and Ellen Frankman is our senior producer. And of course, none of this can happen without Irva Gunja, our executive producer. I hope you get a chance to spend time with people you're thankful for today, and I want to thank you for spending some of your day with us. Happy Thanksgiving. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.